Arthur Ashe said, "Start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can." Hello and welcome to the Dispute Management in the New World podcast. 40 minutes of bi-weekly conversations with Dr. Christopher Malcolm, dispute management professional and secretary general of the Jamaica International Arbitration Center. Today, we continue with part two of our focus on dispute management in the digital age. I'm Roxy Nickel. Hello, Doc.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am good, thanks. So let's continue with this conversation. So can you remind us, because we spoke about it in part one, of some of the major benefits of dispute management in the online space?
Perhaps the most easy to recognize benefit is the ease by which you can get things done online as compared to a lot of traditional processes. And when we think about that, for example, I think it's important to bear in mind that for many of us, particularly those in developing countries, emerging countries, something that we all are concerned about is the area of investment and inward investment. And we do know, for example, that when investors go anywhere, a major concern for them is the ease of doing business. How easy is it to do business? And if you were to look at the component parts of what makes it easy to do business, it's not simply about setting up shop and so on. It's about maintenance. And ultimately, at the end, investors also want to know if there are issues, can they be easily resolved? Mm-hmm. And so to that extent, the ease of dispute management is a critical element to be considered for investors. Now, if we're in that same ease of getting things done vein, we also will recognize that online does present many instances where it makes it easier for disputes to be managed. And if we think as well of cross-border transactions in particular, where you have parties from various countries involved and business activities which touch on concerns a whole lot of countries, in those circumstances where disputes happen, they invariably will involve multiple parties with multiple jurisdictional touch on concern. Mm-hmm. And for them, if you were to think about a dispute to be managed, in those circumstances, the usual position is that you try to find a neutral venue where none of the parties are connected to and where you can then travel to get your physical matter dealt with. Mm-hmm. What online does is that online becomes that neutral venue in and of itself, and you can be in that neutral venue from your living room or from wherever you are. You can participate in that process. So for me, what it is that we find here as a major benefit is the ease of getting into the process. Of course, you add with that, if you start now subtracting time loss for travel, cost related to travel, and all the other matters that you have to deal with when you're crossing border lines, and you now say, but how does that now compare to an online process where all I need to have is access to good telecommunications facilities and so on and so forth. Is there a benefit to be derived? And the clear answer is yes. There are cost benefits to be derived and efficiency benefits as well. Now, in the time of COVID, it becomes even more important because when you're traveling, you very often have to think of what? Periods when you go into quarantine. Mm-hmm. I myself have had that experience. I've had to travel for a matter. And in the traveling, getting to a venue where I had to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. And that was real lockdown in a venue where there was outside my hotel room a table on which my food was placed. I could not leave the hotel room until that 14 days was completed. Did I have a problem with it? No, I couldn't have had a problem because it was part and parcel of doing work. Was I comfortable doing it and was I happy to have done it? The answer is no. Would I have fared better if I were elsewhere and exercising the online option and being there? And the answer is yes. However, the answers are never as simple as that, clearly, because it is also true that if you're, for example, part of a legal team and you're in diverse places, the possibility of working together becomes more difficult. And the nature of advocacy is that you want to, at appropriate junctures, be able to whisper in the ear of your colleague to say, look, I think this is another way you should be doing that or something. And when you're in a digital space, it doesn't allow for that to happen. So there are benefits to be derived, but there are also drawbacks.
Right.
And I think, as in all instances, you have to measure the pros, the cons, and look at what you're trying to achieve to see how best you can deal with it. So I think what has happened, for example, where lawyers are concerned and matters of that nature happening, is that even then you sometimes do not even have a full online process. You may have a completely online element in relation to a tribunal and how things are managed. But where lawyers, particularly if it's a multi-person team, is concerned, you may then having them encamped in a place to ensure that they can have the benefit of close connection and close reasoning with each other, mm-hmm. as they prepare for how best to advance the interests of their clients. So we are working our way through. We have not yet got to that perfect place, but we are in a situation where it very often is online or nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the option between online or nothing being advanced, the likelihood is that you're going to choose online.
You talked about having a team. Have you had that experience where you've had a team of lawyers working together in a particular matter and how it might have affected
the outcome? I've had the experience of the team, and in those circumstances, it was a team having decided to encam together, because to do otherwise, I think, would have been in the worst interest of the client.
Mm-hmm. So that was the best way.
It was the best way. Well, I still believe that, as I said, that even in online matters, in my own view, your better option is still even then mm-hmm. to try to find a way to get lawyers working together. If they're from multiple jurisdictions, if they're from the same jurisdiction, it may or may not be that difficult to bring them together. But if they're from multiple jurisdictions, you do have the issues relating to travel and so on that will arise from time to time. And I think everybody has to be sensitive to that.
Right.
Because these are matters often which are beyond the control of anybody. I mean, the lawyers, for example, in the matter cannot control government policy. But they have to work with them. And I think tribunals, generally speaking, and institutions are generally speaking sensitive to those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And they try their best. It's not always easy to find a good solution. But I think it's something that we're always striving for. And I think as we go forward, and as we're becoming more and more settled into this type of arrangement that we're in, lockdown type error and so on, persons are now getting to refine the processes a little better and are now getting to a point of trying to understand how best to do it so that ultimately the interest of justice and the best interest of clients and so on is not undermined.
Right.
Because you certainly don't want that, because that's a worst case option in my view.
Definitely. So we're moving from individuals to businesses. So we have the larger businesses and the small businesses. How do you see the small businesses catching up with dispute management, or are they in tow in understanding with the big business?
The issues are the same whether you're a big or small business. In a very general way, the meaning that whether you're big or small, you still need to manage your disputes.
Right.
Right? However, depending on the size and complexity of your business, the nature of the disputes that you have to deal with could differ significantly from those of some entity that is smaller. Depending on, on whether you're doing business that's purely domestic in a single jurisdiction, or you're crossing border with your business, that could also have implications for the nature of it. I think as a matter of rule, bigger businesses, it is not unusual, let me put it that way, for bigger businesses to have in-house lawyers and other legal support persons within their organizations who would give them good advice and help them in their negotiations and in other elements of dispute management. Because we have to be careful
mm-hmm.
that when we're speaking dispute management, we recall that we're not simply speaking about dispute resolution. Remember, we're talking about an end-to-end process.
Right.
From the point of idea through to implementation and all the things that flow between and after. So what we have happening is that where an entity has as part of its setup in-house counsel and other persons who are able to provide that sort of support, invariably, it makes it easier for them to have better dispute management service support at the beginning. The extent to which it happens will depend on the experience of the persons they have and the willingness as well of the persons they have on board to venture into new areas. So that's one thing. With smaller entities, the SME sector, we call it, or mm-hmm. even go beyond that, the micro, small, and medium enterprise sector, especially at the micro level, a lot of these entities for one reason or another, do not have lawyers who are in-house or on board with them. So they very often will sort of farm out their dispute management or related needs. And it is not unusual in that sector to find that persons see legal services as a cost that they can do without bearing. So to that extent, it is not unusual then for them to engage in activities without having proper legal support from the beginning. And in a lot of instances, where lawyers get involved for them is at the end of dispute resolution. And by the time you get there, there are very often a lot of missteps along the way, which make the resolution process more difficult, right? So it can be said to that extent that if you were to look at it in that very generic way, that bigger businesses may be ahead of smaller ones,
right,
in terms of how prepared they are for dispute resolution. But you'd be surprised. There's some small entities that have recognized very early, or that recognize very early, that they need to have their lawyers on board as much as they do their accountants or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always comes down to the nature of the business owners, what they prioritize, and how important they see the law coming in. And I think it is critical for us, as persons involved in the field, myself included, to the best we can, assist the MSME sector to an understanding of what law and dispute management can and should be to their operations. Help them to understand that we are not expenses that they should simply overlook, but to try to help them to understand how the services we provide can be leveraged by them in support of their business activities for good. I am of the personal view that dispute management vulnerability and all that goes with it is one of the greatest dangers for businesses of any size to have. And the better you put and the more you put persons in a position where they're able to understand their vulnerability and to be able to manage it, then the better off you make them. And on the question of vulnerability, if I were to just go off a little bit here, you know, I'm one of those of the view that vulnerability is never, ever a bad thing.
Why?
It's a question of how you use it. When you're vulnerable and you recognize your vulnerability, then you can do something about it. But if it is that you see your vulnerability and you try not to move beyond it, then you'll never do anything. And I'll give you a very simple example. If there's a baby creeping, and that baby decides to walk, the moment the baby steps up, there's a vulnerability of the possibility that you're going to fall and injure yourself. But if that baby does not get to a point of being able to recognize the danger of moving from creeping and learning how to surmount that and to get over the idea that I'm in a vulnerable position, that baby will never move from creeping to walking. And there's nothing at all in your life, in your personal relationships or any other relationship, where you do not have to confront, understand, deal with, and then ultimately overcome your vulnerability to move on. So vulnerability should never be seen as some dark thing to be hidden. It's something to be recognized for what it is, and then to determine how best to deal with it, so as to be able to move to the next step. Every step that you move to from another requires you to overcome some level of vulnerability. And if you're not prepared to face your vulnerability, chances are you'll be treading water always and not swing an inch.
Quite so. Well, you kind of touched on the question that I was going to ask about it's being a plus for businesses, which you says dispute management. So have you come across others who are still hesitant to go this route? And how do you encourage them?
There are many persons who are hesitant, and I think the greatest level of hesitance really comes down to being able to convince persons that they should consider the expense and other things related to dispute management as a necessary cost of doing business. And I don't think it's that persons generally don't understand or think that the law has its importance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the general question is there something better I can do with my money than engaging legal services early? Am I better off being in a position where I gamble with knowing that a dispute may or may not arise and then hope that it doesn't arise, rather than putting preventative action measures in place early or avoidance techniques in place early and say, well, at the very least, if I know it happens, then I will go there. But for those persons who are hesitant, I will always say to them, look, think of insurance. When you buy an insurance policy, if you do, you're not hoping, if it's a motor vehicle situation, let's say that, you're not hoping to drive down the road and get into a motor vehicle accident.
No.
But God forbid it happens. You want to know that the insurance policy that you've taken out will be sufficient to take care of your third party and other losses, right? Similarly, and the truth is, if you have that insurance policy and for 50 years you do not get into an accident, at some point you may take stock and say, my God, why did I spend 50 years of insurance premiums for nothing, right? But there's also the possibility that on the day you buy that insurance policy, you could get into an accident, mm-hmm. and then it could pay for it. So you are always, you know, hedging in an understanding that you're taking something, noting that it is the what-ifs that you're protecting for, knowing that a what-if gone wrong could completely wipe out anything that you have been building over the years, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with disputes. If no disputes happen, you're fine, you're sweet and dandy, and you're saying, why should I have wasted my money in the first instance? But if you have not adequately prepared for disputes coming, and then you're hit with something realizing that your contractual terms were rubbish, and that the arrangements that you have put in place because they are not properly considered were rubbish and very one-sided in favor of somebody else. And then you get to a point and you show this to a court or any other tribunal and say, but sorry, you signed on to the dotted line. You're bound by the terms of your contract. And it was for you to have ensured prior to getting into it that you had terms that best represented your interest.
Mm-hmm.
And if at that point, the dispute management provisions that you have there do not enable you to get the best result that you possibly could, at that point you're saying, I wish I had insurance.
Okay. That was what I was thinking when you were talking about having it in your, when we talk about businesses.
Yeah.
I was watching something and they said that they have included this kind of clause with dispute management as the first point of call going through your contract. Is this something that you would encourage businesses to do? Or have you found business that didn't have that in it in terms of having dispute management as part of their contractual structure?
You have a combination of two things happening. There are persons who have never adequately considered business dispute management clauses at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you have things happening where, because the truth be told, if you don't have one, your default position is to go to the court. But as any litigation lawyer will tell you, for example, a bad settlement is better than a good judgment. Why? Because you never ever know what a judgment will yield. But you can create a dispute settlement arrangement over which you have much more control in terms of how the matter manifests and how it is dealt with. And that is something which is critical at all points. So what is happening here is that for those persons who do not go down that route, we're saying, well, perhaps you could and should have. But this is what happens in a real sense in terms of dispute management arrangements when they're properly considered. Because you would have, as parties sat down, or as dispute management practitioners sat down with your client and said, look, let us together try to identify. Remember I spoke about I am at some point in the series.
Right.
Let us try to sit down together and identify what your likely risks are going to be, particularly in the areas that could lead to conflict, right? Let us try to see how we can effectively allocate those risks away from you where possible, or even if with you, in a way which makes it manageable for you. And let us then see how it is that we can manage or mitigate those risks so as to avoid things happening. Now, once you have done that, what have you done? You have now created a formula or created a process which allows you to understand or to enable greater predictability in outcomes. Now, the moment you're able to predict, to have greater predictability, you are reducing uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were to take that in an economic context, a great cost to any business, any entity, is the cost of uncertainty. Why? Because where something is uncertain, you have to plan for it nevertheless.
Right.
But you don't know what you're planning for. If you are able to sit down and properly devise dispute management, knowing it is an inevitability, and you are able to better establish and make it more predictable as to how it will manifest, you can say, well, instead of planning and setting aside $100, I know that my maximum exposure is likely to be $50. And it's almost like a limitation of liability clause, but a little separately by reference to contract provisions. But I won't get there for the moment. But let us say you're able to then predict that and you know you have to put aside $50. What does it do? It allows you to have an additional $50 of cash flow available to you to do something else. And as a business, what are you able to do? You're able to invest that additional $50 and earn on it. So it can, instead of being something which is simply an expense, be established in a way where it can be effectively leveraged to bring greater certainty to what it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And by bringing greater certainty, you're able to reduce your contingent liabilities. And by doing that, it has a multiplier effect, because let's go back to that same example. Let's say instead of planning for $100, you're planning for $50. What does it mean? If you are borrowing money, you don't have to borrow $100, you can borrow $50.
Okay.
So there are the mathematical implications of that are huge. And I think one of the things we haven't done well enough is to see how we are able to understand law and the area of dispute management by reference to its economic implications, and by reference in particular to its possibility for leveraging. And leveraging is not really a language that a lot of us lawyers and so on speak about, but it is something which we have to think a lot more of, because law is really at the core of economic activity. And if it is at the core of economic activity, it is then a tool of commerce. And if it is a tool of commerce, it must be leveraged and treated like any other commercial tool should be treated.
Now, we've been talking about the businesses. Are there any businesses that are, you would say, more should lean towards dispute management, or everybody has that will affect them at some point or the other? So it's not one more than the other.
I think every business has to deal with it. There are some industries which are more prone to disputes than others. So let's say you go down the street in a regular contract and you buy a pound of flour. The chance of that contract going bad is not as great. And the majority of contracts for regular consumer things go without disputes happening. The majority of them, right? However, if you are in the construction sector, the majority of construction projects have disputes on them.
Mm-hmm.
It is unlikely that you're going to have a house built, a bridge built, a pier built, or any such thing without a beam being built lean, the foundation not having had the right cement poured in it, or some other such thing. And that's the nature of the construction sector. So whereas with your ordinary commercial contracts, ordinary ones, the majority of them go without a lot of disputes manifesting on them. In the construction sector, it's completely the other way around. It's the unusual project in the construction sector which will end without a dispute on it. So I would say, in the construction sector, more than any other, and when I say construction here, we're talking about general infrastructure. It's not just about building houses and so on. It's about bridges, it's about oil rigs, it's about a host of things which are generally considered to be in the construction sector. So what it means is that when you're in that sector, you need to bear in mind that disputes are likely to happen, more likely than not. So you must plan for them. And in fairness to the construction sector, you have standard form contracts and so on, which generally are geared to include dispute management options, expert determinations, all these things are there. The difficulty, however, in relation to that, is that many persons simply take a precedent, apply it without having considered what its implications are.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered when I held a particular office, I saw persons bringing documents to me to look at with dispute settlement clauses in them. And there were constant, you know, references, for example, to arbitration or something else. And I'd very often ask, no, you have brought this thing to me, it has an arbitration clause in it. Why have you put it in? And an answer very often comes back to say, because we normally do.
Mm.
And I said, okay, fine, let us state that a little further. Now that you have looked at this thing, this is a contract that you're trying to deal with. This is an arrangement that you're trying to deal with. What is the likelihood of a dispute happening under this contract? And I say, okay, fine. Now, this contract involves three components, Which of the components is it likely that the dispute is going to happen in? And they say, okay, fine, component A. And I say, what of component B, A, B, and C? Oh, those will not have any disputes because A, B, C. And I say, okay, fine, I've heard that. So I said, the contract price is for what? $20 million, let's say, right? And I say, okay, fine. And I said, the overall exposure, therefore, you're saying, is let's say $20 million. Let's just use that as a round figure for right. purposes of the argument. So I say, if we're to back out B and C that you're saying are not likely to give rise to disputes, what's the value of component A that you're saying is likely to give rise to a dispute? And they say, okay, fine, $5 million. So I say, okay, fine, but this clause that you have put here requires you to do A, B, C, D, E. Would you agree with me that you have built in a dispute management clause for $20 million? And the answer is, yes, it appears so. So I say, would you then also agree that you have built in for an additional $15 million and by extension built in a more costly dispute settlement process than you need to? Mm-hmm. Why do you need to do A, B, C? And that is part of the analysis that doesn't very often happen. So you hear people sometimes saying, oh, arbitration is expensive and this is expensive and so on. It's not necessarily that the processes are all that expensive. It's that the processes are very often not understood. They're not being properly used. And by extensions, persons say they're expensive without understanding that it is about understanding processes mm-hmm. and being able to leverage them by reference to what your needs are. Mm-hmm. So there's a needs analysis that has to be done. And a lot of people don't go through that process of taking the needs analysis. Why? Because they don't see dispute settlement very often as critical to their project objectives. But I'm suggesting that because disputes are so crucial, and as lawyers, I tell people I'm a dispute management practitioner, you know why? Because the only real service I can give to anybody is to help them to manage how disputes are. If it's an economic analysis, the economist will do that. Mm-hmm. If it's about accounting, the accountant will do that. As a lawyer, I'm there to help you to avoid disputes or to help you to resolve them when they happen. So for that reason, it behoves me to take an analysis of what dispute resolution processes are likely to do mm-hmm. in any given situation, and then to have a process which properly deals with that. And I think that is part of where I think, as we talk about capacity building and going forward, in the digital age or in any other age, we now need to start looking by reference to an economic analysis that works. Because what you don't want is to have processes made available to persons which are too expensive, not properly considered, mm-hmm. and therefore you lose out on the efficiency, including cost efficiency, that you're hoping for. And then the processes themselves end up getting a bad name, not because they're inherently bad, but because they have not been properly used.
Oh, thank you so much for clearing that up. So the JAISC has a digital platform. What propelled the establishment, and how does it function?
Well, the establishment of a digital platform was always considered, but I think the process to establishing it was quickened by COVID-19. Mm-hmm. We got to a point where we recognized that we had a physical platform, which would have its limitations because there were period of lockdown and so on. And at that time, we also recognized that there was a global move to digitization. And if you're moving to digitization, the processes in support of that overall move, including mm-hmm. dispute management, should be there. And because, again, my own position is that dispute management is so critical to the overall process, the process for overall digitization should never be one done properly, in my view, without also involving a dispute resolution process which is digitized, or at least capable of supporting hybridization, mm-hmm. even if not full digitization in the way we're thinking about it, being fully online. It should, at the very least, be capable of supporting hybridization. Right. So the online platform that we have built, iNeutral, is one which is geared to having things completely online or to support hybridization in appropriate instances as well.
Is there a one-on-one for you to speak with them? I don't know if you call it a consultation, to in order to give them an idea of your services and how best it would serve them?
There's always a capacity for dialogue, and I think dialogue is a two-way street, really.
Right.
And information, accessing information and understanding information is always also a two-way street. The truth is that there's a lot of information out there. A lot of it people don't understand. That is true. But there's also a situation where a lot of information is there not found because people do not search for it.
Right.
So there are those, you know, conflicting positions that we have to be dealing with. But in the context of the JAIC, what we have sought to do is to establish what I think are fairly clear rules, have them put on a website. We are available for persons to contact us through, if they, for example, sent an email to info@jaiac.org or were to call 876-416-5390 and to then seek to have further dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That can be had. But I also think persons who are in the space, let's say the trade organizations and so on, through your private sector organizations, through your chambers of commerce and so on, I think those entities, your master builders and everybody else, they too, I believe, in service to their own members, have an obligation, I think, to work with them as well, to assist them in understanding things along this line. But as I say, you know, even though dispute resolution and management, as I consider it, is so critical, it is also true that in the context of a lot of these trade organizations and so on, that is not central to their thinking. So I think it is for us who are in the field to also get our way to the table, to be able to influence the conversation a little more. So in the case of the JAIC, for example, it is a member organization of the Jamaica Chamber of Commerce, and there's also membership now with the Private Sector Organization of Jamaica, and there is connection beyond Jamaica into other organizations of this type as well. And I think that is something, I think, at every level that has to be done. And when we go there, it should not simply be about making a business pitch for work to be done.
Right.
There's also an important dialogue or reasoning or capacity building process, which I think we should encourage and support. And that is why, in the context of the JAIC, for example, there was such a move in this period to establish an online webinar series during coffee time at JAIC, which is readily available online. What we have done in that so far, if persons were simply to go to coffeetimejaiac.com, you would see information there as to some of the programs that we're doing. Are we perfect? Far from. Is there still a lot to be done? Certainly. But I think we have started along a path, and we've been doing it with a view to saying we have an obligation, and we consider it as such, to ensure that there's greater knowledge and information sharing across borders, and not just by reference to, you know, what we do in any particular jurisdiction, but ensuring that we have international thought leaders sharing their views. And from those views being shared and from a process of discussion and reasoning, as we call them, we're then able to think of better ways to doing things and to ensure that ultimately the persons that we serve and the economies in which we function are the greater beneficiaries of the work and service that we're providing.
Great. In regard to, we know, the digital age, things are always changing. You will come up on different circumstances. Do you see for your platform an additional set of services based on what you may be approached to do or to look at by clients?
Well, I'll tell you, the platform we have developed is expandable and developed to be expandable.
Okay.
And part of that is a recognition that things change, times change, circumstances change, and requirements change.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are there to serve those persons who require dispute management services, then it is for us, as we have considered it to be, to put ourselves in a position where we can be responsive to needs as they arise. And that is what I think we are doing.
Okay, so right before we wrap up, Doc, can you tell our viewers and our listeners how, again, they can get through to the JAIC and the services you offer?
Well, the JAIC, the easy way to do it is simply to visit jaiac.org, and you will there be able to see the suite of services and other things that are offered, including looking at the rules that we have available for the conduct of arbitrations, mediations, and so on. In addition, more specifically, since we're talking about online,
right?
If persons want to simply go directly to the online portal that the JAIAC offers, they only need to go to ineutral.jaiac.org. That is ineutral.jaiac.org. www.ecosystemsolutions.org, and there they will find a lot of information. And of course, if ever they go there and there are issues or questions that they have, there are help features that are available. But in addition, they can always send an email, as I mentioned earlier, to info@jaiac.org or call 876-416-5390.
Oh, thank you, Sodok, so much, because we learned so much, as always. And I know our listeners and viewers have enjoyed and thoroughly been informed by you. So, like we said in the beginning, we're going to wrap this up with the quote from Arthur Ashe, which says, "Start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can." Please remember to tune into all of the podcast series episodes on dispute management in a new world, available on Buzzsprout, Podbean, Spreaker, and the JAIAC YouTube channel. Until then, I'm Roxy Nickel. On behalf of Dr. Christopher Malcolm and the entire production team, thanking you for tuning in.
This program is produced with the kind sponsorship of the Jamaica Deposit Insurance Corporation, JDIC, protecting deposits for you and me.
I save because one day my little business is going to be a big deal.
Yeah, and I make sure to put away a little something for him.
And thanks to JDIC, deposit insurance protection on my savings gone up.
You've been upgraded. Deposits held in commercial banks, building societies, and merchant banks are covered under the JDIC deposit insurance scheme up to $1.2 million per depositor per institution. JDIC.
Protecting deposits for you and me.
Special thanks to ADEB Consultants Limited, consulting engineers practicing for over 40 years. iNeutral, dispute resolution made easy. CP Malcolm, dispute management practitioner. Caribbean Institute of Alternative Dispute Resolution Limited, CIADR. Mona Law Faculty, the University of the West Indies, Mona.
Impact Justice, improved access to justice in the Caribbean.
All our podcast episodes are distributed by these platforms: Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Deezer, Stitcher, Podcast Index, Pandora, TuneIn Plus Alexa, Podchaser, Podcast Addict, and wherever else you get your favorite podcasts.